Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. Today, I'm joined by two extraordinary women, if I can get the word out. They're both doing amazing work. They're both based up here in the Seattle area, but that's not why I selected them for today's show. I chose them because they really are doing great work and making a huge difference in the lives of many people. Coming in the second half of today's show, a Seattle doctor sheds light on what it's really like for families dealing with mental illness. Through her work as a doctor and award-winning documentary filmmaker, Dr. Delaney Rustin takes a look at the human side of mental illness. She shares her journey as a daughter who wants to reconnect with her schizophrenic father, a father who wants to stop his medicine, and a system that fails them both when he does. It's really a very moving, enlightening story, and she has a lot of good information for people who might be dealing with the same kind of situation. First, I'm pleased to welcome back to Conversations Live Dr. Gloria Burgess. She's the author of Dare to Wear Your Soul on the Outside and is a speaker, corporate consultant, executive coach, and a poet. She's also the founder and principal of Jazz Inc. Dr. Burgess joins us today to talk about creating bridges from what was and what is to what can be. Gloria Burgess, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Vicki. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
And it's a pleasure to have you back. I love your work because one of the reasons when I was looking at the book again this weekend and thinking about the work that you do is you really do come from a very authentic place. You don't fill your work with, you know, wonderful sounding cliches that really don't mean anything.
Yes.
And last time you were here, you shared the wonderful story of the difference that William Faulkner made in the life of your father and how that ultimately has influenced you to live a life of gratitude, of love, of wisdom. Yeah. And integrity and legacy. And for listeners who aren't familiar with your work, Gloria, or missed you last time, I wonder if you'd just share a little bit about what you do and where you're coming from.
Absolutely. I have been living my life, Vicki, for the last, I'd say, maybe 10 dozen or so years with intention and purpose about crafting the legacy that I will leave behind. And I want to just talk a little bit about legacy. The work that I do as a professional is involved in the world of education. So I'm a teacher. I'm an instructor in various colleges around the Puget Sound area. I also teach in communities all over the world. My work has really called me to be a ambassador, if you will, beyond our own country. I'm also a consultant, so I work in different kinds of organizations, corporations, schools, universities, government, et cetera, as a consultant, leadership consultant, as well as an executive coach. And so all of those threads of my work, I try to walk my talk and encourage my clients to do the same thing. And so when I talk about crafting a conscious legacy, I'm really talking about being on purpose and being really focused on the kind of work that I do, the kind of relationships that I build, who I include and who I, you know, may not include for various things, who I collaborate with, how I use my voice in the world as well as in my at-home relationships. And I try to, you know, just live a life that's aligned and congruent. And, you know, I don't always succeed. You know, I'm a human being.
Right,
but
right.
That's my goal.
But I think it's good for people to hear that you don't always succeed because there's a tendency when we're not feeling great about ourselves or about certain accomplishments to think that everybody else has it under control and we're the only ones who don't.
And let me tell you, everybody else does not have it under control.
Right, right.
Yeah, and that really is the essence of the work that I do. You know, a lot of people reach out to me, Vicki, to ask me to come in and work with them one-on-one coaching or whatever, because they know that there's something more than that they can strive for in their relationship life or their work life, and they see what's possible. And, you know, they just maybe need a little coaching or nudging around the edges.
Mm.
And I think that people are drawn to my work and to me personally because, you know, I just try to tell it like it is. What you see is what you get with me, and it's no sense pretending.
Right.
And I try to help my clients do the same thing.
Right. And you really do believe that our primary task in life is not about serving our own ego. It's about being of service to others, whether that's relationships, family, community, and even beyond that.
Exactly. And so the word that I'm using, legacy, I want to just underscore that it's not all about you. It is about getting your own act together and you know, putting it on the road, so to speak, but in service to something beyond yourself. So it's about reaching out, building bridges, connecting the dots, helping other people do the same kind of work that you have done for yourself, or to you know just help them realize what they want in life and to make their lives fuller, richer, and more rewarding.
Mm. I'll tell you what else I like about your work. You can laugh at yourself because I think that's very important. I think we often take ourselves much too seriously.
Well, you know, I do too. There's a wonderful little phrase that I've coined, and it's actually the name of my book. It's called Dare to Wear Your Soul on the Outside. And people ask me, you know, well, does it hurt to do that? And I say, well, sometimes, yeah, it does. But, you know, what hurts even more, Vicki, is not wearing your soul on the outside, because when we say yes to our own calling, to our own agenda for our lives, life just goes better. And when we say yes to other people's agenda for our lives, that's where we begin to settle for a life that's too small for us, and we end up, you know, hiding out or pretending to be somebody else, and that's when it really hurts. And we find ourselves, you know, in the middle of our lives, perhaps with our, you know, Joseph Campbell would say, with our ladders up against the wrong wall. You know, we've spent too much time and energy investing in stuff over here when we should have been maybe, you know, doing things in another way.
Mm. And I want to talk about that today because I've certainly been there. You know, I had a career for 15 years in the financial industry, which I, for the most part, I enjoyed. The last few years, I didn't, and it was a struggle to think about, okay, where do I go from here and what do I do? Many people are forced into that situation now, whether it's, you know, like me, I was going through some kind of early midlife crisis. This was in my 30s, but because, you know, age has nothing to do with midlife crisis, I don't think.
That's right.
You know, but other people are being forced out of jobs or their jobs are being redefined and they're finding themselves displaced one way or another. And often, even though they're physically going through the motions, emotionally, they're not ready for the changes or they're resisting the changes. And there's a great quote from the Dalai Lama I want to read. He says, we also often add to our pain and suffering by being overly sensitive, overreacting to minor things, and sometimes taking things too personally.
Mm.
How do you think we add to our own suffering and prolong our own pain?
Well, I think one of the ways we do that, you know, I when you were talking about your 15-year work in the financial world, I added to my own pain, and I think a lot of us do this, by over-identifying with our work in particular, with our jobs, our careers, whatever you want to call it, but we over-identify as if that work is all, you know, that defines us. And, you know, we're so much more than our jobs. About 15 years ago, I found myself with my ladder against the wrong wall, so to speak. I had, you know, spent about 20 years in the high-tech industry in computer software. And I found myself with a pink slip in my hand. And I was so disoriented. I really didn't know who I was, what I was supposed to do next, because I had over-identified with my role and my job. And I realized at that point that I had a choice. And I could define myself by my work and, you know, my professional status, if you will, or I could define myself in other terms. And I chose the second option. because you can always choose your attitude. Mm-hmm. You can always know that power is not outside of you, that it really resides inside of you. And so I made, you know, some very difficult realizations, and I began to turn my life around at that point. It didn't happen overnight for me, Vicki. It was a process. I'm still in the process, if you will. And I have learned so much since that time. And I now look back on that period of my life, that 20-year period of my life, not so much as, you know, I wasted my time, I invested my time poorly, but I look at it as a training ground,
right,
and as a learning ground. And it has so prepared me for the work that I do now, but I couldn't see that then.
Yeah.
Okay, now with 15 years hindsight, I'm going, well, of course I would have had that, you know, opportunity to learn and grow. And now I can harvest that and use it in my current work, in my current life.
I love that expression, you can harvest that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because people have often asked me, well, how did you get from, you know, financial industry to communications? And wasn't that a waste of time? And I say absolutely not, because I really learned the psychology of dealing with people, marketing, sales, training. I mean,
yes,
there's so much there that you just take into your next career with you.
That's right.
Yeah.
Let's
take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk some more about how people can learn to accept, you know, what was, what is, and then move forward to what can be.
Okay.
We're talking today with Dr. Gloria Burgess. Her book is called Dare to Wear Your Soul on the Outside. Live your legacy now. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Walk with me a while. It's quiet by the river.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Join us October 12th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair to learn about the movement that's already helped millions of people. Following the gang-related murder of his son, Azeem Kamisa was devastated, but he now carries his inspirational message of forgiveness, peace, and hope into the world. Hailed by dignitaries such as the Dalai Lama, former President Bill Clinton, and Al Gore, Azeem joins Vicki St. Clair for Conversations Live on Monday, October 12th at noon Pacific. Call 800-495-7617 for more information.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Down to the river, I can't forget her, I'll stay forever.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Dr. Gloria Burgess, author of Dare to Wear Your Soul on the Outside. And we are talking today about the importance of legacy, of wearing your soul on the outside. And Gloria, years ago, I read, I was lucky enough to go on a week-long retreat with Dr. Stephen Covey. Mm. And he talks intensely about similar kind of thing. But he says, live your legacy now. You know, why leave a legacy? Live it when you can live it now.
Yeah.
And so many people right now are going through changes that they may not necessarily want to go through. When we are in that state, when we're in a transition state that we're not welcoming, but we know intellectually we have to do it, but mm-hmm. emotionally and spiritually we're not on board, how do we start to get on board with that?
Well, one of the ways that is very helpful is to just take stock of where you are, Vicki. I think a lot of us tend to live in this place called denial.
Yeah.
And so we kind of pretend that we don't have to confront what's right in front of us. So just, you know, standing still and giving yourself permission to say, here is where I am right now. And once you can define and accept current reality, whatever that happens to be for you. You know, you lost a job, you lost a spouse, you have a diagnosis from your doctor that you just, you know, knocked you off, you know, just knocked you off center. Whatever it happens to be, you're looking at the next part of your life, and you realize that the number of years ahead of you are shorter than the ones that you have behind. So whatever that transition moment is to really, you know, stand still and say, this is where I am. And from that place, when you actually name it and claim it, you can then begin to say, okay, now what can I look forward to? What do I have in my future? If you don't stand still and take stock and tell yourself the truth, you're really building on a very, I'm going to say, unstable and in some cases a false foundation. So defining that place of current reality helps you secure the foundation that you can then launch off from for the next part of your life. I have a friend, and I'm going to call her by name because I don't think she'd mind me telling her story at all. Her name is Joan, and she's in her late 60s now. And this woman has lived, you know, just one of those fairy tale lives where she had it all, lots of friends, lots of wonderful relationships, lots of money. And she lost it all. She lost that financial underpinning. She lost a whole constellation of friends through a lot of different, things that happened in her life. And she found herself in her middle 60s wondering, okay, so now what? And she realized, Vicki, after she kind of took stock of where she was, she realized what she could, what she had, what strength she had, what skills she had, what talent she had. And her financial situation, you know, she was found herself divorced as well, having to provide for herself. And she decided, what to do with the second half of her life. She decided that she could not bear to live here in the United States doing the work that she had spent the last maybe 7 or 8 years preparing for, which is hospice work. But she could maybe earn a living and give something back in another country where the cost of living wasn't quite as high as our own country. And so now she's working for the Peace Corps in Botswana.
Wow.
And she's doing hospice work with people, primarily young people, who are facing their own mortality because they have AIDS. And she's finding a way to use those wonderful skills and gifts in a different kind of context, totally outside of her comfort zone, but she's finding a way to make a living, give back, and to be a good steward, to build a bridge from her past life and inventing her way forward into her future life.
Mm. I think often we've got to have to one way or another let go of a lot of stuff before we can open ourselves up to new beginnings, can't we? You know, one of the sadnesses in my life is that my father never came out to America, even though I lived here for 20-some years before he died. Mm. But he was always going to do it when he retired, and of course he never did retire. He was afraid to retire, not for financial reasons. I think he just was afraid that he was going to retire and die, and he died anyway.
Mm-hmm.
How do you work with people when they have that kind of mentality? They're just afraid to let go of what is, even though it's not an ideal situation.
Well, one of the things I ask them, and this is where my sense of humor comes in. You know, I ask them, you know, is it going, you know, is whatever you're holding on to, you know, your home, your finances, your possessions, whatever it happens to be, I said, is it going to help you, you know, when you're 6 feet under? And usually most people answer, well, you know, no. And can you take it with you? No. And when they, you know, just kind of face those seemingly simple questions, they realize that, you know, maybe they are really holding on a little bit stronger than they need to. And I don't want to make light of anyone's circumstances, certainly not your father's or anyone else's. And, you know, I think, again, we invest so much in our relationships and our possessions, if you will, our jobs, and our identity gets confused with those things, those material things, in some cases, and we lose track of what's really important, which is, you know, who we are at the core, And that's really the only thing that we can transport with us.
Yeah. You talk in your book about having faith in yourself. What does that mean to you, Gloria?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. It means a lot of things. At the core, having faith in yourself fundamentally is about believing that you have the resources, that you have the power to make things happen in your life. It's really a way of saying, I believe in myself. Faith is also about being able to put your vision, your goals, your hopes, your dreams out there and having faith that other people will say, wow, you know, I want to help you get from here to there. So it's about having a belief in yourself and a belief that other people will conspire with you in a positive way to help you move forward with what you want to create. You know, when I talked about my dad's story before, Vicki,
mm-hmm.
I'll just tell a little snippet of it now, but, you know, he told his story over and over and over and over again about wanting to go to college from the time that he was a little boy until he was in his early 20s. And he kept putting it out there in a place, time in an era in our country where, you know, he didn't know, he didn't really know if he would have any collaborators, but that didn't stop him from putting it out there. And eventually somebody heard him who was in a position to put him in touch with somebody who was not only able to help him, but really give him a leg up, a boost up, to move him in the direction of his dreams. And so faith is really, it's having faith in yourself, faith in other people. And for me, it's also faith in a power beyond people. It's a faith in the divine. It's a faith in God, in a force that it's way more powerful than you are.
Mm. What kind of mentors do you see coming, emerging from these times? Who are some of your mentors?
Well, some of the mentors that I see emerging, I'll answer that question first. Mm-hmm. I look at our president, President Barack Obama, and I see him as a mentor, not only to me, but to a lot of young people. And the reason I say that is because when President Obama was elected, young African-American boys in particular changed some of their fundamental behavior overnight. So, you know, some of the young people who used to run around with the baggy pants and, you know, the crotch hanging
right.
down to the ground and the chains and all that stuff,
right.
you know, literally overnight they pull their pants up. Okay, and so now the challenge is how to keep their pants up, right?
Right.
And to keep them moving forward. But I say that, you know, he's one of the primary mentors. It's because, you know, now young men of color, black men in particular, but young men of color all over the world have somebody in a position of authority and power who looks like them, who has had some of their experience, and now these young people have something to aim for. So he's one of my role models and mentors, if you will. My mother is, you know, I don't talk about her a lot. She's still alive. She's almost 80 years old. But she teaches me every single day how to live well. You know, sometimes my mother can't get out of bed for about an hour because she can't feel where her feet are. She has a peripheral neuropathy, so her nerve endings don't quite, you know, connect with the brain sometimes. But she lays there and she, you know, says a prayer, she gives thanks, and she, you know, she just is so grateful for the little bit that she can do. And eventually, you know, she works herself out of bed and downstairs. She's still on her own, living mm-hmm. in her own home. But she's one of my role models. She tells me, you know, by her behavior to keep moving, do what you can with what you have, and don't complain. Count your blessings. Don't complain.
Yeah.
So those are two of my models.
That's awesome. I have a mother like that too, suffering two debilitating diseases, and she does not complain. She pulls her bootstraps up every day, she says.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and it's really all about putting one foot in front of the other over and over and over again. And if you fall down, you know, you pick yourself up and you dust yourself off and you keep moving.
So going back to your book, Daring to Wear Your Soul on the Outside, if I want to dare to wear my soul on the outside and start living my legacy today, what's the first step I should take? If I do nothing else, what should I do?
The first step is to I'm going to say the first step is to say yes to your own life, Vicki, and to say no to other people's agenda for your life. When you say yes to your own life, by default, you're saying no to other people's programs or agendas for you. And the way you know that you're saying yes to your own life, because, you know, people ask me that all the time, well, how do I know? How can I be sure? The way you know is you are so supercharged.
It feels good.
It feels good, and you can't wait to get out of bed in the morning, okay?
Right.
You know, because you're on fire, you're just kind of burning up when you're with other people, when you're talking about what you're doing and how you're living your life. And I'm going to say you burn with the kind of fire that doesn't require any wood.
Oh, I love it. I love that.
And you're so excited and full of joy. Other people are going, wow, how can I get some of that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's always a pleasure talking with you, Gloria, and I really appreciate you being with us today. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
I would like to say, don't think about your legacy as something that is disconnected from your life. Okay? It is not. It is not about death and dying. It is not about a financial inheritance. It's not about sprinting to the finish. It's about each and every choice you make every single day, because we get to leave a legacy whether we're conscious of it or not. So get conscious and stay conscious.
Thank you so much. Wise, wise words. And listeners, you have two websites, GloriaBurgess.com, and Burgess is spelled B-U-R-G-E-S-S, GloriaBurgess.com, and Jazz-Inc.com, Jazz.
Yes.
Jazz-Inc.com. Thank you. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, do visit me on my website, please, and visit my blog. There's always lots of new information there. And I just want to say thank you again, Vicki, for hosting me and for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And please stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking to another amazing woman, Dr. Delaney Rustin. She's a doctor of internal medicine who is making films about controversial medical issues. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Do you have legal questions, need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick & Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Get current weather, traffic, and news. Visit 1150kknw.com and stay informed with Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back. We talked in our first segment today about service, about legacy, about building bridges from what was and what is to what can be. And we're now taking that discussion to a whole different level. My next guest shares her journey as a daughter who wants to reconnect with her schizophrenic father, a father who wants to stop his medicine and a system that fails them both when he does. Delaney Weston is a doctor of internal medicine and an award-winning documentary filmmaker. 10 years ago, she formed an independent production company where she produces films covering controversial medical issues. Dr. Weston began focusing on mental illness with a short about her relationship with her mentally ill father. That aired on PBS and became the catalyst for her recent feature documentary, Unlisted, A Story of Schizophrenia. Welcome, Dr. Delaney Weston. Pleased to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about your work, first of all. You serve the underserved Pike Place Market. Are you still down there in the clinic down there?
Yes, it's been 4 years that I've been seeing patients there. I would say about half of them have severe mental illness. And so in a given day, seeing 25 patients, probably 12 will have either bipolar or schizophrenia or really severe depression.
Mm-hmm. And you grew up with your father actually had schizophrenia, I think, before you were born. Is that correct? He developed it while he was a graduate student?
Exactly. And that's when he met my mom at UC Berkeley. So he was eccentric, but, you know, that was the 60s. And my mom didn't know anything about the illness, you know, at the time.
Yeah.
And so they did get married, even though she knew that he had been hospitalized one time.
Mm. And because you see so many people in your daily practice who are disconnected from their families, and then your son started asking you, you know, what about Grandpa? And you say in the film, what kind of legacy am I leaving my son if he doesn't even know his grandpa? You set about this journey. Tell us a little bit about what led up to wanting to reconnect with your dad, because you'd been disconnected for, what, 10 years?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, Chase, who at the time was 5, was asking just simple questions about his grandpa. Particularly, I brought up that my dad plays chess, and Chase had started in kindergarten a chess club. So that really brought up him wanting to know more about his grandpa. And I didn't know how to approach that with him in the same way that in my family it wasn't really talked about. And I didn't want to continue that secrecy in my family. So it really made me have to reconsider how I was going to have my dad in my life.
Mm. And you disconnected him because why? Because he was embarrassing you and causing issues when you were at school?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. When I was growing up in Berkeley, he would show up unexpected in a psychotic state at my high school. And when I was in medical school in the Bay Area, he was doing that too. And I was just, particularly in medical school, so worried that and not ready to be his care provider that I became unlisted in the phone book, mm-hmm. not wanting him to show up in these states.
And that's where you got the title of your film from, mm-hmm. Unlisted, right? Unlisted,
yeah.
A Story of Schizophrenia. So tell us a little bit about paranoid schizophrenia. I understand it affects 1 in 100, 1 in 10 commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
What does it look like?
Well, the amazing thing about it is that it is so common. And yet part of the illness is very much of a retraction, of people hiding, of not wanting to be out in the world. So in fact, when we do see people somewhat delusional or talking to themselves on the street, that's actually a very small percentage of people who have the illness, because so many of them are just more like hermits in their little apartments or living at home or in other situations. So we're really not seeing the full silent epidemic. I think that what's so important to note is that people can do quite well with their schizophrenia, particularly on medicines, and they'll have difficulties and some memory issues and some keeping focused on a topic, but they can do quite well until relapses, they're called, of the symptoms really take hold, which often is paranoid thinking, delusions of either that being persecuted is a very common one, and so there's many different types of schizophrenia, but paranoid schizophrenia is the one that we hear and know most about, I think, in the media, if we hear anything at all.
And they commonly hear voices, because you said in the film, I think, to your father, you know, what happens when you hear voices? And he said, I just turn up the radio.
And I still don't know what he means by that. You know, he also said, I hear my mother talk to me, but Delaney, you will too when you're my age. And which was in making the film and connecting with him and trying to understand his story and have other people understand it. It was hard. A lot of his responses, how to make them, how to understand them. But I don't know if he heard voices. Not everyone with schizophrenia does, but they can just have delusions where they're perceiving things differently.
Mm-hmm.
But then they can also hear voices, but very rarely to have visual hallucinations. And in fact, as a doctor, if somebody is in the emergency room or having visual hallucinations, we're much more likely to look for an organic brain injury or a chemical induced. So that's the idea of The Beautiful Mind, the famous movie.
Right,
to have
right.
those really clear visual hallucinations is very uncommon.
Mm. And something else that is unknown, because you've done extensive research on schizophrenia, obviously, I've heard frequently that drugs can lead to schizophrenia, and yet the research says that's not necessarily so. There's no evidence for that.
Exactly. The same proportion of people who are using LSD and other, you know, hard drugs will ultimately develop chronic schizophrenia than those that haven't used it. They haven't found a direct causal relationship. People can have drug-induced psychosis. I don't mean to say that they can't look very much like schizophrenia, but to really develop the chronic illness that unfortunately is not curable but only treatable at this time, it's not been shown to be caused by drugs. There's more research now about marijuana actually being a trigger, being associated with a slight increase, but it's really about possibly manifesting the illness as a trigger environmental factor that will cause it to be expressed perhaps earlier.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about your dad. One of the things you said in an article I read, that you were surprised how much people were endeared toward him. And I thought he was quite charming, I'm sure very difficult at times. But you could also see that charm and that humor. He laughed quite a bit. There was one scene where he says to you, I didn't come to your high school graduation, didn't get an invitation. I didn't come to see you graduate from Cornell, didn't get an invitation. And he goes on and then he's like, what does an invitation look like? But he's laughing at the same time. Tell me, what surprised you most about your dad when you did reconnect with him?
Well, I think that is a big part of it. Having a camera person and a sound person there with me at all, you know, during a lot of that, how much they saw his charm and his humor in a way that I realized how my experiences him from in the past were really clouding my getting to appreciate that. And also, I really had grown up taking the bus by myself, starting 8 or 9 to go visit him right by the UC Berkeley college campus. And I was always by myself, and if anything, very fearful that my friends would see us. So I hadn't really shared him with other people. And to share him with him doing well on a medicine, it really got to open my eyes and feel really proud of him. And
you hadn't even shared much about him with your husband. Your husband said, well, you just went blah, 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 in 5 minutes, and that's all I know about him.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't make light of this, because your childhood was difficult because of his outbursts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at a very, very young age, you said your mother and your grandmother would say, make sure your dad takes his meds. I mean, it's a lot to expect from a young child.
Mm-hmm. You know, it amazes me. I'm sure you encounter this a lot, of how much we can be open in certain areas of our life and completely shut off, because there was a way we have a very open dialogue with my husband, and this area of my life, I just couldn't go there. I didn't want to think about it. And making this film was really my coming out about something that I see all the time, which is that severe mental illness tears families apart, but not because the reasons you might expect so much. Yes, the symptoms are really difficult, but really getting treatment for people can be so devastating for the family that they end up throwing their hands up. And that's really part of what happened to me when I was in medical school and my dad was showing up. Trying to get him care was so daunting that I felt like I just couldn't emotionally try to take that on.
Yeah, well, a lot to handle. And your mother didn't want anything to do with him. He had remarried, but they didn't have any connection with him either. Mm-hmm. I noticed that the daughter of his second marriage is also a doctor. Any kind of correlation there between wanting to fix people? You're both doctors. And
I think that's a great question. And I've asked her about that and never really got a real strong answer from her. I do know for me it was very much my interest in providing care. Interestingly, I definitely didn't want to go into psychiatry because that just felt too close to home. And yet now I have found myself really doing a lot of psychiatry and in the places that I work, and that's actually become really fulfilling.
Mm. And you very much, when you connected with him, took the role of doctor, and you say at one point, I'm tired of being my dad's doctor. I just want to be with him. Tell us a little bit about that.
As you mentioned, since I was as 6, 7, I remember his mother saying to me, "Delaney, get your dad to take his medicines." And I would try and try. And it was always a really difficult situation with my dad because I felt like I had no input. And when my dad... So that was really trying about that, mm-hmm. just not having input.
Right, right. I'm sure. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Delaney Rustin. We'll talk a little bit more about the film because it really is a great film and some of the work that she's doing right now, working on other films. And we'll also talk about how the system failed them, what we need to know about how the system failed them. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Please stay with us.
Girl, you know that I'm a troubled man. Girl, you know that I'm a troubled man.
If you missed the show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Thanks for joining us on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. If you have comments or questions on any of our shows, we want to hear from you. Email info@conversationslive.net. Call Vicki toll-free at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or leave a message at our special listener voicemail box, 206-414-6159. That's 206-414-6159.
Talk radio with a difference. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
For the times I...
And welcome back. We're talking today with two remarkable women. I'm talking right now with Dr. Delaney Rustin. She's a doctor of internal medicine and an award-winning documentary filmmaker who's really making a difference, making films about controversial medical issues. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Delaney, and this is in the film, you went to, at one point, you made several visits down to see your father. You come back, you talk with Jim McDermott in Seattle. He's a congressman here. What kind of conversation did you have about why it's so difficult to get help for the mentally challenged?
Well, he really shed light to me as a psychiatrist who was practicing at the time that the laws were fundamentally changed across the country. It began in California, which was... trying to give patients more rights, which was a good thing. But in doing so, they decided that you really could only commit somebody in a psychotic state if they were just imminently about to hurt themselves or someone else. So that the criteria is so strict to hospitalize somebody against their will, it's really for people who haven't experienced trying to get their loved one care in that state, it's almost incomprehensible. And Jim was really did a great job of succinctly saying how the political place of America was ripe for that to happen.
Mm. There's a few scenes in the film as the story progresses. I mean, you have conversations with your father. You just wanted to be with him. As his daughter, not as his doctor, but you go down. You come home to Seattle. You start getting phone calls. He's behaving bizarrely. You're afraid he's come off his medicine. You go back down to look for him, and nobody knows where he is. He's been at a facility for I don't know how many years, but he's been at an assisted facility for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And the release has expired. They won't talk to you. Tell us about that and what that was like for you.
Well, it was really shocking, in part because as a physician, I actually really did not know those expired. I thought that once you wrote that you give consent to your care providers or your housing place, that your family member could be informed on things, that would continue ongoing. So I was really shocked and also felt like this was an emergency situation. To have the doors slammed on me like that was in part why I'm doing... I was shocked emotionally, and then it also I've gotten strength from it to remember that we have shut out families now for so long, starting in the 60s, that we need to have discussions now and readdress this so that this doesn't keep happening to other family members.
Mm. So tell us about the search. I mean, how did you go about looking for your father? You literally were out there on the street, weren't you, talking with people?
I was, and it was... definitely surrealistic. I mean, I couldn't believe this was happening. He had, when I reconnected with him for 2 years, really done so well. Again, speaking to the ability for community care to really make a difference with people with severe mental illness. He was in excellent supportive housing, a new medicine that made our being together great. It made bringing my son Chase to meet his grandpa a really wonderful experience. And so to go from that to suddenly absolutely missing, having gotten phone calls from him in a psychotic state, is really devastating. So I really just had his photographs and was asking people on the street if they had seen him. And, it was very emotional, and he did end up calling finally a family member, sounding pretty hysterical, but at least saying he was going to come back to Los Angeles. So there was a sense of relief after 2 days of going to the police station and other places.
Mm-hmm. And you ran into somebody and he said, well, he was a little concerned that he might commit suicide because 1 in 10 does commit suicide. And I bring this up and I want to be very sensitive to you because obviously this is not a pleasant, reliving experience. Mm-hmm. But you said, well, I'm not so worried about that because he's never really talked about it. He's never tried. Mm-hmm. A thing that most of us would, say in that situation, because we tend to think suicides have a track record of attempted failures. And you really didn't believe at that time that he would commit suicide.
Not even the teeniest bit in my mind at all. I mean... And I watched that scene in the movie, and it's painful because I wish there was a part of me that had been more like, oh, yeah. And the denial of thinking that could happen is so profound. So that is hard for me to rewatch.
Yeah, and I bring it up only because I think many of us in that situation would think exactly the same thing. You know, we often, when we're under extreme stress, we look at those patterns, and that pattern was not there with your dad. And of course, he did end up committing suicide, unfortunately. You said you felt an incredible anger at the system that failed you.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that. How could it have helped you? Mm-hmm. What would have made things easier for both of you?
Well, I think the promises of the 60s to close a lot of awful psychiatric hospitals, and many of them were, but to shift that money, and that was a lot of money, into a comprehensive community care system, would have really made a difference for my dad and I. For example, I would now and then go to visit him. He was living in a boarding care at one time, mm-hmm. and people were overly medicated, literally drooling, pacing. And the difference between seeing that to where he was now, where there was on-site support groups, really highly trained caseworkers, psychiatrists, and administration people that I was interacting with. I feel like if my dad had had that. Mm-hmm. It's not just an apartment. It's not just a little studio. It really takes a lot of committed people. And I think that we could have had a much more of a daughter-father relationship.
Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of criticism of the British medical system with Obama bringing his plan into, you know, into play here and trying to get it approved. And the British public, I have to tell you, has been really upset by the way the American press has handled it, because they're saying, well, we have a great system and the things that we see in America would never happen here in Britain, that is. And certainly I was thinking, you know, of all the cities I've been to in America, Washington, D.C., and Boston, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, where you just see whole parks that are dedicated to homeless who need mental facilities. Mm-hmm. And you just don't see that in Britain. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a great point. I think a lot of those people that were seen homeless in the parks and on the streets, you know, over half of them have significant mental illness. And the goal really is to keep them in the community, but it's going to take people actually doing a lot of visits to where they're living and things like that. And in England, there is more of a paternalistic, and this is me speaking as an internal medicine doctor, one example I can give. There's for end-of-life care, for example, we are very much give it to the families to decide, you mm-hmm. know, when life should end. And to me, that is an incredible burden we're putting on families. And in England, they are more paternalistic about that, working with the family. But this, I was in England and studying this issue. I was doing ethics research, and I was very much interested in this. And I thought when we talked about it, and they have, you know, committees and ethic groups, I thought they did a really good way of handling it and to put that all on the family. And with mental illness, to put it all on the family, that you be the care provider, because there's very little other supports. And then when there's crises, to shut them out makes it doubly hard. Yeah. So I feel pretty strongly about a lot of the positive things that England is doing.
Yeah, Jim McDermott actually said that when you were talking with him, that we view mental illness as an individual problem, and that as a society, we have no responsibility for it. It's all on you. It's all on the family members. We're almost at the end of our segment, Delaney. I read in an article that you feel your heart opened up. It was bittersweet when he died, but I was so thankful to have the pain. Tell us in what ways you think you changed on your journey, reconnecting with your father and going through this with him.
I definitely had a part of my heart that was closed off. And in reconnecting with my father and breaking open that frozen part of my heart made me feel more truthful to myself and also to my kids, to not have this secret, and then also just to the work that I do. One of the biggest changes that has happened is that I began this journey to reconnect with my dad and to make it a film with bigger meaning. Well, now my work has really become an advocacy and even doing a lot more and, you know, going on the road a lot with this. So that was unexpected, too.
Yeah. How can people see this film, and what do you want them to take away from it?
Well, actually, on October 23rd, it will be showing at Northwest Film Forum, and they can go to my website at www.unlistedfilm.com to learn more about that, and also to get on email list so that for other screenings, and then also the DVD will be available soon, and then, you know, further broadcasts will are in the works.
Hmm. Well, it's an amazing film. You did a great job. Not easy because you have such an emotional tie there, and I'm sure there were. I'm sure it wasn't as easy as you're making it sound. But I think you're doing great work, and I look forward to seeing more work from you. What are you working on now, real quick?
Well, I'm Where in the World is Mental Health is another feature that I've been working on. So I was able to film in a psychiatric hospital in China, and a man with schizophrenia, and also in France, where they're rated number one for healthcare.
Oh, are they really? I didn't know that.
But not for mental health, but just in general. So I followed a man there with schizophrenia, and then going to be doing this, and started doing that in Seattle, and going to compare just overall more of a global perspective on how we are all taking responsibility or not.
Okay, excellent. And your website again, unlistedfilm.com, correct? Check it out. I think you'll really enjoy the film. It's really eye-opening. And if you've got questions or feedback on today's show on either guest, please leave me a voicemail message or call me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or you can find me through our website at conversationslive.net. I thank you so much for being with us today and look forward to being with you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Join us October 12th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair to learn about the movement that's already helped millions of people. Following the gang-related murder of his son, Azeem Kamisa was devastated, but he now carries his inspirational message of forgiveness, peace, and hope into the world. Hailed by dignitaries such as the Dalai Lama, former President Bill Clinton, and Al Gore, Azeem joins Vicki St. Clair for Conversations Live on Monday, October 12th at noon Pacific. Call 800-495-7617 for more information.